Now, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard? Not billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the place to be.
The place to be, yes. It's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can...
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another great episode of the Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and with me, as always, is the original Big Punisher, straight out of Norwalk, Connecticut, my PIC, Scott Criscolo. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, Mr. Rosero. Pleasure as always. And the keys are right next to me.
Yes.
We all know what tonight is. So.
Grab those keys and hop in the DeLorean and set the date to November 1988 as we hit the second annual Survivor Series for our Vintage Vault review this week. Looking to wrap up the year that is 1988. It's been a pretty good year so far.
It has. We've had some good storylines as the year started. We've had some interesting title changes and a lot of interesting stuff. Actually, we've seen some debuts, and boy, do we got some for this show.
Yep. As we mentioned at SummerSlam quite a few times, Survivor Series 88 is really the show where we see like the full transition from the rock and wrestling era to the era. I don't know what to call it, really. It's not quite the new generation yet, but kind of just the era that my generation grew up watching, those guys. I really don't have a name for the era. The Warrior era, I guess. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I guess it's like the Federation years part two.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of hard to explain, but
from now until like around like, you know, the end of 91, really.
Yeah, it's almost like the advanced Federation years, because you have, when it comes to the Federation years, for those that may not understand, is from 1985 to 1993. And really, 85 to 88, they still were kind of in the TV dark ages. Things still looked old and kind of, I don't know, it still had that very grizzled TV look where it still was, it didn't quite look fresh yet. But this was probably the time of year where it started to kind of turn around. Mm-hmm. And then from 88 to 91, and obviously 88 on, things actually started to look fresh. Things didn't look dark. Production quality started to go up. That's pretty much what it comes down to.
Yeah, hype. And you just get that new crop of guys that really would be the standard bearers of the promotion through the, you know, purge of 92 with the steroid trial and all that stuff. So
exactly.
This is where we get that whole crew comes in. And this is really we'll call it the Hasbro era, because all these guys are the Hasbro figures that we grew to know and love and collect. So, all right, so let's get things started. I'll let you, as always, set the stage.
Okay, let us turn back the clock. The date is November 24th, 1988. Live from the Richfield Coliseum in Richfield, Ohio. We are back there again.
Mm-hmm.
A very kind of a sparse crowd, 13,500. But we talked about this when we did the 1987 Survivor Series, that the place is kind of unusual for a pay-per-view. We won't get into it again because we feel the premise is the same. Vince, after this show, doesn't come back here for almost 4 years.
No, it's actually a lot smaller, because we have the attendance at 87 is 21,000 on our reviews.
Yeah, so there are a lot of no-shows for this one. The buy rate is 2.8. Now, what was the buy rate for 87?
Let me check. And then I'm going to double-check with Wikipedia. I want to see if those attendance figures are the same, because we did these reviews a while ago. So
right, exactly.
But we have the buy rate as a 7.
Okay, so the buy rate went down almost half, almost two-thirds.
I'm sure pay-per-view grew quite a bit, though, in that year as well.
True.
All right, so All right, so his stage is set, and do you want to start with the opener?
Here we go. Yes, I will do the two. Only four matches, so this will actually be kind of a hustle show. I will do the two odds. You can do the two evens, which means you get to do the main event. Buy rate 2.8. We're back to after that unusually bizarre combination of Gorilla and superstar Billy Graham. We are back to normal. A sense of normalcy in the commentary booth as Jesse is back where he belongs. Back in his seat, so he's back at it'll be him and Gorilla again. So at least we get some, and he's needed here because Jesse, when we get to the end of the show, really takes the story, the main storyline of the company, and really throws a little spice into it.
Yes,
but we'll get to that when we get there. Our opener, and I have to say, in the last every Vault podcast you and I have done in the calendar year of 1988. We've been salivating for the chance to finally talk about this match, and now it's in front of us. We've been saying nonstop at how awesome the tag team division was in the WWF in 1987-88. And this match right here is the template for the tag team division in 1988. You could not get literally any better than the crop of guys in this match right now.
Now, I do want to clarify, because I think similar to our issues with the last couple of shows, I'm sure we watched the Coliseum home video version. The actual event, this tag team match was second, and the opener was the Ultimate Warriors team against the Honky Tonk Man's team.
Okay, which is, I think, next, right?
On the tape, yeah. So we'll go with the version we watched on the tape, but just know that we, the actual event itself, we are fairly certain was flip-flop.
Yeah, so really the only thing, the only difference here is these two matches are flip-flop. This was second, but that's fine. Honestly, this match probably should have been first because the crowd would have gotten a lot hotter. But anyway, it is the, now again, the only difference this year is I don't think we have a women's match, do we?
No.
No, thank God. So we have, every division. Just for those that didn't get a chance to listen to it, and if you haven't, please do. We do have the Survivor Series 87 podcast on our site. Every aspect of the company in the late 80s was covered at the first Survivor Series. You had a women's division match, you had a tag team division match, you had a mid-card division match, and you had the main event match.
Mm-hmm.
This year we ditched the women because women were non-existent for at least another. Well, not non-existent, but not there wasn't enough good women to come up with a good match. So, but this opener is just the standard bearer because you literally have every single awesome tag team. What makes this even better is we have two debuts in this match. Both teams that would make their mark throughout wrestling, and of course, one of the teams has a guy that would make one of the greatest marks in the history of the business. So, the teams are on the babyface side, the teams are the Powers of Pain, the Warlord and the Barbarian, who debuted at SummerSlam, the Heart Foundation, who are full-fledged faces now, of course, the Hitman and the Anvil, the Young Stallions, which consists of Jim Powers and Paul Roma.
Now, they won, obviously, they were sole survivors of this match last year, along with the Killer Bees.
Yes.
But, it's good to see Stallions still going strong here, even though I think this is pretty much it for them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they're just in the match because they're good fodder, and, they're two good-looking guys, good physiques, and, the chicks dig them, so. And the British Bulldogs, who, obviously, as we've already said, this is definitely the end for them. So, this is the last time you see Dynamite Kid on pay-per-view television ever, so. And one more team, a team that makes their debut here. So we have one babyface team making their debut and one heel team making their debut.
Mm-hmm.
The babyface team, straight out of, and this is actually their second go-around in the WWF.
Yes.
And that is Marty Jannetty and Michael Hickenbottom, otherwise, of course, known as Shawn Michaels. This is, of course, the debut of the Rockers.
Right. Now, both these men met in Central States in 1985.
Yep.
Jannetty had been bouncing around from team to team, and Michaels has kind of been working the circuit as a singles guy. So I think it was May 15th, 85, they teamed up, and that's where it all began. From there, they headed to the AWA in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
They were known as the Midnight Rockers while there. Had a great feud with Buddy Rose and Doug Summers, back and forth, trying to win the tag team titles. They finally would win them.
Mm-hmm.
And then in late 87, they jumped to the WWF.
Mm-hmm.
They had their first match on a dark match or a house show. It was actually TV taping. And then they went to a bar after the show. And, you know, there's a couple of various versions of the story out there.
Yes.
One has them partying like crazy. The other has, according to Shawn Michaels, was that they were kind of goaded into partying too hard.
Yes. By of all people, Jimmy Jack Funk.
Yes.
So
so that's kind of the rumor that's out there
right.
from both ends. So either way, Vince brought them in the next day, fired them both. So obviously they were pretty upset. They thought that they had blown their one big chance.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't go back to the AWA. They actually went down to Memphis where they hung out for a while. And then they did eventually go back to the AWA as the Midnight Rockers. Won the tag titles again, lost them to Bad Company. And then they were called by Vince, and they headed back to WWF in mid-88 and made their debut on June 18th in a squash match.
Ah, okay. Here's a little trivia question for you, Mr. Azar. I don't know if you know this, and I have a – well, you know what? No, I'll ask you, and then I want – for those that want to comment on the Facebook page, if you knew this too, do you know who Shawn Michaels' first professional opponent was in his first professional match?
I feel like I do know it. But okay. I'll probably never think of it right now.
Okay. It was Billy Jack Haynes.
Oh, okay.
In World Class in 1985.
Interesting.
Right before it. He was in World Class, then he went to Central States, but he was in World Class first. And his name was actually spelled Sean, S-E-A-N, which he had to change because that Shawn Michaels is a porn star.
Yes.
But I guess for Shawn's character 10 years later, it probably would make sense. So, anyway. So the Rockers were the final face team. The heel team, the heel teams are Demolition, your World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. The Conquistadors, yes, our fine golden-clad masked duo.
Yeah, now we haven't really talked about them, right? Because they were not at Survivor Series 87.
No, they were not at Survivor Series 87.
It was actually their debut as well.
Yeah, Conquistadors, one of those teams that, you know, you really can never say who they are. They kind of bounce around various promotions. They're a team, you can't really say they're a single team. They, you know, different guys have worn their outfits, but they've been bounced around different promotions. They've been in NWA, they've been in AWA. I've seen them in Florida. They're just like one of those. They're a name of a team, a mystery team you can use if you need a mystery team.
Right. Here they were portrayed by Jose Luis Rivera and Jose Estrada Sr. Both have been jobbers for the most part, and they just kind of stick them under the suits. So they're pretty much a jobber to the star team. One of those teams that was given a few wins over jobbers and then used to build up legit teams.
Right. Exactly. So they're in this match. You have the Bolsheviks, who seem to be everywhere in every match. And that is, of course, Nikolai Volkoff and Boris Zukov. The Fabulous Rougeaus, Mr. Azzaro's favorite French-Canadian team.
And really settling in now in their classic heel role by this
point. Yeah, exactly. Yep, they got their little fleur-de-lis Tyson, and they're doing well. And the other team making their debut... the other in this match, and that's the one heel team. And it would be funny because the Rockers and this team would end up feuding for about 6 months after this, the two new teams. That team is, of course, Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson, the Brainbusters. And, of course, they were managed by Bobby. That's thus their name, the Brainbusters.
I'll let you give their backgrounds because I know you're very, very excited for this one.
Yes, I was extremely excited. My brother was pretty stoked, too. For those that obviously don't know, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard are two-fourths, a.k.a. one-half of, and I'm sure, and I'm going to say this, and this is one of those big Scotty C. things that usually flame some type of war, and if people agree, that's cool if they disagree, but they are one-half of the single greatest heel faction in the history of professional wrestling, and that is, of course, the Four Horsemen.
Yeah, baby.
Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson, Ole Anderson, and of course, World Heavyweight Champion, Nature Boy Ric Flair. For their actual background, Tully is from Texas, from the San Antonio area. He was one of many guys that went to West Texas State. He was a quarterback. He's actually the only guy, I think, that played offense. I think everybody else played defense, all those guys went there. May have been one, I think. Actually, Tito Santana, I think, was a tight end. I think everybody else was like defensive ends or linebackers.
There was actually, just a quick sidetrack.
Yeah.
They actually had a pretty cool piece on Classics On Demand. I don't think it's up anymore. Where they actually went through all the guys that competed at West Texas State and all throughout wrestling history. Jim Ross hosted. It was pretty cool.
It was excellent. I watched it as well. It talked about Stan Hansen, who actually didn't go there. he was like the gym rat of the team.
Yes.
But Bruiser Brody and obviously the more well-known guys, Ted DiBiase, Dusty. Hey, baby. Yeah, he went there. So, but Tully was a quarterback. Everybody else, I think, were linebackers and linemen. He was actually a quarterback. And he started in his father's promotion. Joe Blanchard actually ran the promotion in San Antonio. And I believe Shawn Michaels, ironically, wrestled there, obviously, because that's where Shawn's from. And Tully started there, and he actually worked a great tag team with Gino Hernandez. They were an awesome heel team. And then Gino turned face. Tully turned on him because that's what Tully does. And then they feuded. So Gino would end up going to World Class, and Tully would go to Mid-Atlantic. Arn Anderson, Marty Lund. Arn was born in Georgia. He started in Georgia. And he was wrestling there for a while. He actually, an unknown, if you have the Road Warriors DVD, he is one of the jobbers. There's a jobber match, Hawk and Animal, against him and some stiff, I don't know who. And the Road Warriors essentially destroy them. So that's a little known fact. Arn Anderson, jobber to the stars in his time in Georgia. But if anyone is going to find you, if anyone's going to discover you, it might as well be the man. And Ric Flair saw Arn Anderson, saw something in him, brought him to Charlotte, and the rest is history. And by 1988, they were the Four Horsemen, and they were obviously red hot, unbelievable faction of guys who weren't just, you know, bad guys. They were great wrestlers, all champions, and they lived the life. They were horsemen off camera. Which was probably one of the reasons why Jim Crockett Promotions went out of business. Because I think they spent so much money on them, they didn't spend money on anybody else.
Very true.
But by late 88, Tully and Arn thought they were getting kind of stiffed on the paydays. They thought that they were giving Rick more than everybody else, which they probably were, but he was a world champion, so he deserved it. Not that they were mad at Rick about that. They were more upset at Jim and David Crockett. So Tully and Arn bolted, and Vince was brilliant to bring them in. And here they are. And obviously, there's no other manager that would give these guys justice than Bobby. They had to go to Bobby.
Yeah.
They couldn't go to anybody else.
No, it just made sense.
Yeah, exactly. Because actually, in unwritten circles, Flair has always called Bobby the Fifth Horseman. So, made sense. So, they're the last heel team. So, as you can see, this match is loaded with unbelievable talent all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I were Paul Roma and Jim Powers, I'd be like, wow, I don't think it's going to get any better than this. and Roma would become a horseman 8 years later or 5 years later. So so the match in general is outstanding. I mean, just everybody gets their chance. Everybody's red hot. The activity in the ring is hot. The energy level is high. You could tell that Gorilla and Jesse are totally into this because this is where all the work rate is. The work rate is all here. And the match is that's worth it. It's 41 minutes, and it deserves that. It's a tremendous match. I gave it a high grade. You gave it a high grade. It just deserved it. It was just a great match of all levels.
Well, it's everybody's a great mix involved. Too of talent and storyline, which we'll get to in a second. Right. But there was a very heavy storyline woven throughout the match, and I agree. The action was tremendous. So let's just run through the eliminations quickly, and then we'll get into the big storyline. So the Hearts eliminate the Rougeaus, kind of putting an end on that feud where they had the double turn.
Yep.
Then the Bolsheviks take out the Young Stallions, and then shortly after that, the Rockers get their first pay-per-view victory as Marty Jannetty pins Boris Zukov to eliminate them.
Yep.
Brainbusters get their first major pay-per-view victory as Tully pins Bret Hart in 26-22. Now, what a great singles match that would have been. I'm curious if they fought.
Oh, that would have been awesome. I don't think any doubt. I'm sure they were floating around some house show somewhere.
And then setting up the feud you mentioned earlier, the Brainbusters and Rockers are both disqualified for fighting and brawling in 27 minutes. Shortly after that, about 8 minutes later, Demolition eliminates the British Bulldogs, and that is it for them. Well, as far as Dynamite's concerned, definitely for him, we will see Davey Boy pop up shortly after this. Demolition is countered out at 39 minutes, and then the Powers of Pain win the match by beating the Conquistadors. So they would be the sole survivors of Powers of Pain, and as if that win wasn't big enough, they're also part of this major storyline. So what would happen is Axe, I believe, was about to hit the ropes. Mr. Fuji pulls the ropes open, and Axe tumbles to the floor, and Demolition gets countered out. You know, and everyone's wondering why Jesse and Gorilla are kind of freaking out, trying to figure out what's going on. Why would Fuji do that? Axe turns around and Fuji drills him with the cane. Axe and Smash beat up Fuji, slam him on the ground, and leave. The Powers of Pain come out, dust Fuji off, and he goes into their corner as they destroy the Conquistadors to get the win. Now, it was also pretty shocking that Conquistadors made it to this point as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. As it turns out in the end, I think it was more just fodder for the Powers of Pain. I don't think you wanted to see a good heel team have to job at right. this point.
Plus, you wanted to have a team that would get some sympathy. You know what I mean? If it was the Bolsheviks in there, they're right. not going to get sympathy. But the Conquistadors were such an underdog team, and they they hung on and kept hanging on. And that was kind of another story throughout the match, is that they would get the shit kicked out of them left and right by all these great teams, and they kept barely either roll out of the ring or fall into the corner, and keep surviving throughout the match. So it kind of built some sympathy. It was actually a very, very well built match.
Yeah, it was. And the questions lingered. I mean, I remember, obviously you don't talk about this kind of thing back then because, you know, we were all still in the kayfabe era, but you look back now, you're like, why would Fuji have dumped the World Tag Team Champions for this other team just like them?
Made no sense. That was the one thing I always kind of bugged me about this. It was a great, great storyline. It was very well done. But yeah, and I didn't really ever understand. The only thing I think I've seen someone try to explain it as is saying that Fuji was fed up. His demolition was getting too big and stopped listening to him. And he wanted to prove that he was the man behind the team. So by, bringing a new team to beat them for the titles, he would prove that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, I guess that's fine, but still, I mean, they were just, obviously it was just because they were so ridiculously over, the fans wanted them face.
Yes.
So this, make Fuji look like a dope, which is fine with you because you hate him anyway.
He's no Frenchie Martin.
Oh, okay. Okay. And the Powers of Pain, again, they just look better as heels. The two teams just look better in the roles they would end up becoming. So it made sense to do the switch. It was just weird because you got to try and figure out the logic of why Fuji would dump the tag team champions for this other team. It just didn't make any sense. But besides that, that doesn't take away from the package of the match. Not at all.
No.
It was just because it was something the fans wanted. They wanted Demolition to be the baby faces. They wanted to cheer them. And the Powers of Pain probably just weren't getting the juice that they were anticipating. Besides, they're both guys are better as heels anyway, Barbarian and the Warlord anyway. So common sense wise, it just worked out. But the action in the ring, and I remember, I think Tully and Brett went for a good 3 minutes, I think, three and a half minutes, which is just such a tease for two ridiculously good singles guys. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Brett was not quite there yet. You give me, Tully 86 and Brett 94, and you got yourself, eight stars, much less five.
Yes.
But here still, though, I mean, Brett was Brett. He still was. The baby fat was pretty much off him at this point. He was looking really good. And I'm sure those two would end up, obviously they would end up having a great match in the following year, which we'll talk about when we get there. But overall, just a great match. I wish it was the opener. It felt good to be the opener watching the tape.
Especially coming out with 40 minutes, like you said, to give them that much time to really develop and tell a great story and get all these teams time to showcase themselves. I mean, the first elimination came 5 minutes in, which is still a pretty good chunk of time.
Yes,
exactly. For these matches. But then the next one didn't come till 15 minutes. So, most of the teams outside of the Rougeaux got at least 15 minutes to kind of work their way into things.
Exactly. And so Demolition is now officially good guys, and the fans, that's what they wanted. So people were, that was it.
And we should mention too that they come out after the match and brawl with the Powers of Pain.
Yes. So they establish themselves, and then that sets the tone for the next, the next, what, 6 months of, or 5.5 months of,
yeah, they pretty much feud right through WrestleMania from here on
exactly.
out.
Exactly. So, as for the, we'll talk more about it when we do the Rumble, the Rockers and the Brainbusters would pretty much feud for the next 6 months. And apparently, and you've heard this from Sean says it on his DVD, and you hear it, just watch the matches. Their house show matches were unbelievable.
Yeah.
They were just all over the place. And,
there's been a few pop up on various tapes and DVDs, but.
Yeah, one is on the Tag Team DVD, I believe.
I know there was one on the old Best of Saturday Night's Main Event tape. I don't know if there's one in the Saturday Night's Main Event DVD, but I know there's one on the old tape they released back in 1989, 1990.
Yeah, I have the DVD. I just pulled the DVD out of the library. Let me just take a quick peek. and see if that match is on here. Let's see.
But yeah, they definitely did, and it's kind of actually curious why they didn't, and we'll talk about it further when we get to our WrestleMania review, but why they didn't feud right through that show. Seems like maybe a match they would have had there. So
exactly. DiBiase, I don't think it's on here. I think a lot of these are the – seems like a lot of these are the – or a lot of Savage stuff, a lot of Hogan stuff. I don't see any I don't see any tag. Nah, it's not on here. I know the I think one of Sean's DVDs, I don't know if it's Heartbreak and Triumph or My Journey. I think it's My Journey has a Brainbusters Rockers match. I know there's one DVD has a match from Madison Square Garden, and one DVD match is on a DVD is from Boston Garden. I just pulled out the Allied Powers DVD, which is of course.
And I'm pretty sure they also popped up on a couple of these house shows that have aired on 24/7 as well.
Yes.
I know we've seen. I think there's one that was kind of disappointing. It was either on a prime, maybe it was actually on a prime time, around that time where they only fought for a couple of minutes and ended up brawling and having like a big double DQ and they go in. Yeah. They went nuts brawling with each other.
Mm. On disc one of the Allied Powers set, March 18th, 1989, from Madison Square Garden.
Okay.
And then they also wrestle at Boston Garden, and I'm not going to look it up. We'll move along. But I think it's on one of Sean's DVDs.
Okay.
I think it's – I don't know if it's My Journey or if it's The Heartbreak and Triumph, but one of his DVDs has a match from Boston Garden. But, yeah, they had – and, yeah, if you go on 24/7, a lot of the house shows that we've dubbed, I'm sure they've wrestled. But the matches, their chemistry was unbelievable.
Didn't they have – did they have an Iron Man match?
You know what? I don't know if it was an Iron Man or a 2 out of 3. That's a good question.
Yeah, I got to ask my buddy Graham. I don't know what he – oh, here. Yeah, that's how you find the results.
Yeah, I'll have to ask our man Graham. Graham Koth on his site, historywwe.com. Go to it anytime you need any kind of info. The guy's a machine. It's a walking almanac. We'll have to talk to our man Graham. I'm pretty sure it was either an Iron Man or a 2 out of 3 falls. I don't remember which one. But in any case, they would wrestle for the next 6 months. And apparently the house show matches were off the charts. And why would you? You have four awesome workers. Marty was in a good groove here. So we got to give him his props. Marty was in a good groove here. Sean, a little rusty, a little green still. But you know, you're dealing with a very young team in the Rockers. You know, they've been around for 2 years, but a little earlier, a little older than that. But obviously dealing with taking on Marty and Arn and Tully, you're dealing with two absolute pros. So it just worked perfectly. Good. I got to give Vince credit for that in the bookers to give them. And those are the kind of matches you want. That's the kind of matches you pay for to go to house shows.
Yes.
You know, those are the special gems that you don't get to see on TV. So I am. That was fun. So that was one reason why I was stoked to see these guys come to the WWF, Arn and Tully, because you knew they could fit them in. And then they would end up having an awesome 1989, or at least first 7 months of 1989. So there you go. And the Hart Foundation just kind of – this is their kind of floating aimlessly phase now.
Yeah, the next year.
The Hart Foundation just kind of bubble around a little bit. Bolsheviks are Bolsheviks. They do pretty much do the same thing. The Rougeaus kind of get their moments here and there. They do get a couple of title shots, I believe. Obviously the big two teams, the Demolition and the Powers of Pain, they're on their run too. So great match all around, great work rate, and obviously storyline wise they were able to splinter off, and we had our setups for the next 6 months of tag teams. So great opener.
And we've talked about what happens with the Bulldogs from here, so we don't need to really go into
This is it for Dynamite. He's gone, and then Bulldog leaves for a couple of years. And we'll see him in about 2 years. So
okay. All right, so the next match, which, as we mentioned, was actually the opener, is another mid-card battle here. Pretty much the upper mid-card guys. Maybe a couple upper mid-card guys and then a bunch of scrubs. But one team was led by the Ultimate Warrior, the new Intercontinental Champion. On his team was Brutus Beefcake, a new face here, the Blue Blazer, Sam Houston, and Jim Brunzel. Taking on the Honky Tonk Man, Danny Davis, who's still hanging around, yeah. Greg Valentine, Ron Bass, and Bad News Brown. So the heel team, we pretty much know all those guys. On the face side is the debut of the Blue Blazer, who's portrayed by Bret Hart's brother, Owen Hart.
Mm-hmm.
He trained in the Dungeon, had a very successful run in kind of the revamped Stampede when Stu brought it back after he closed it initially when he sold to Vince. Owen kind of helped revitalize that business. Yep. Of course, the whole story is he wanted to be a fireman. He couldn't get on the fire department in Canada, so he turned to wrestling. And we'll chronicle his very, very interesting and eventually tragic run as we go through these reviews.
Yes. And something that, of course, you'll be obviously you already know, and maybe some of our fans don't. I believe Owen was in a tag team where he was working with in Stampede, a very young, unknown up-and-comer by the name of Brian Pillman.
Yes. Excellent team.
Yes. So,
and also in this match, as I mentioned, was Jim Brunzell, who was formerly one half of the Killer Bees. He's actually subbing here for Don Morocco, who was supposed to be in the match but quit or was released shortly before the show. So Brunzell's filling in. And this is it for Sam Houston as well. He's gone after the show as far as pay-per-views go. So that's our final show here for him. And actually, let me just pull up and see where he headed off after this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he pretty much just used his enhancement talent. He left in early 89 and headed to USWA, where he hung on, had a really brief run as enhancement talent for WCW, and then bounced around until actually 2007, which is when he finally called it a career. Mm. So that's it for him as well.
Yeah, solid guy, always a good worker. They were a good team, but they kind of got lapped, and just fresh talent came in, and they just didn't have any more room. So it's a shame. Another good team that never really got a chance to hold the straps, but that's what made the tag team. That's what made the tag team division back then so great, because it was a log jam at the top. And, teams just battling, and Gorilla always talking about being number one contenders and stuff. So the Killer Bees were a team. My dad was always one of his favorite teams when I was a kid and we were watching wrestling together. He always loved the Killer Bees. So farewell, Jim Brunzell, guy that was in Ric Flair's class in Vern Gagne's barn school in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes. Well, he'll hang around for a while, though, on TV.
Yeah. This is his last. But we don't see him on pay-per-view again, right?
No, I don't think so.
He's not the Rumble, I don't think. No. So, okay. So, and by the way, Morocco. Speaking of Morocco, quickly, we'll mention it briefly at the end of our podcast. We've been talking in our last few podcasts about our Intercontinental title tournament that's been going on our board, Bigelow34ProBoards.com. We had an interesting little, for once, usually it's you and I, sparring. But you and I actually were on the same side in a debate involving Don Morocco. We'll talk about it at the end of our review. But we had an interesting little thing on the board today about about Don Morocco. But at this point, as we mentioned at the SummerSlam review, he's gone. So
yes, he's done.
So as for the match,
actually, this is it for Danny Davis too, right?
Yeah. No, you don't see Danny Davis. Yeah, at this point, he goes off camera for probably a year, and then he just goes back to being a ref.
Yes.
And then no one ever talks about him again.
Well, Gorilla, I think I've read and actually heard in some commentary, he would always kind of like reference it a little bit, like his past and stuff. Like, he didn't come out and say it, like, how did he get, but he just kind of, I think they did the whole probationary thing with him a little bit too.
Yeah, and he ended up just being a good ref again, and then he just refed, and that was it. Yeah, they didn't talk about it anymore.
Yeah, so, and then Ron Bass, I think he's at the Rumble, so we'll talk about him then.
Yeah. The match itself, obviously, a couple reasons. You have one of the top babyface mid-carders, and that is, of course, Beefcake, one of the most popular guys in the company. But obviously, this was a showcase for the ever-burgeoning fan base that is the current Intercontinental Champion, the Ultimate Warrior. This was actually a good team put together, in my opinion. I don't know what you think, but it was good to have Beefcake and Warrior together, because you had so much drama coming up in the main event. That it was good to have Beefcake and Warrior, the two other really big babyface fan favorites, in this match to kind of give this match a little happy sizzle.
It's pretty much the whole match is pretty much them. The feud is them against Honky and the rest of the guys that is kind of supporting players. I mean, Bad News Brown's still getting a push, and as we'll see for the first time of two straight years, he walks out on his team here, playing up on the whole that he's a loner from the streets and isn't into the team concept.
Right.
And Valentine, obviously, associated with Honky Tonk Man, both managed by Jimmy Hart. And as 1989 dawns, they start to team up a little bit for the early part of the year. So,
right. Exactly. And Honky doesn't quite start jobbing yet. He actually him and Beefcake get counted out about 15 minutes in, about a little under 16 minutes in. So he hasn't started to look at the lights yet, but he will be soon.
Yeah, it's almost like they were kind of keeping that feud going. I'm fine with Warrior not pinning Honky because he decisively beat him at SummerSlam. So
exactly.
And then Warrior gets to look strong. He takes out Bass and Valentine within like 20 seconds of each other. So
right. Yeah. It's a good match. It's you know, it's more. This is more for the sizzle of the crowd. Get them happy. Their guys win and look good. And that's pretty much that. The heel team is really full of stiffs, to be honest with you.
Yes.
So, and they were pretty much dispatched. So this was just another match to showcase the good babyface fan favorite mid card that Vince had right now. And Beefcake and Warrior were on the forefront of that. So. And what do we give these? What do we grade these matches? I don't think we did much, right?
A little bit low. Yeah, I mean, there were standard stuff. I mean, with the guys in there, it was hard to get too excited.
Right, exactly.
Guys like Bass and Brunzel and Sam Houston and
Danny Davis.
Yeah, there wasn't too much to it. I guess we didn't run through all the eliminations, right? We just did a few. Beefcake eliminates Davis about a minute in. Brown pins Brunzel and then walks out 2 minutes later, so he's eliminated. Ron Bass takes out Houston. Valentine pins the Blazer. Honky Beefcake get countered out, and the Warrior takes out Bass and Valentine to be the sole survivor.
Yeah, and I wonder if obviously Owen deserved his opportunity. I always wondered what the whole background. I wonder if this was a favor for Brett, probably a favor from Stu. I guess there's rumors. Where did that story start? Was it on our Facebook page where allegedly, I guess they had to restart Stampede because Vince owed Stu money and. He stiffed him, or where do we hear that story from?
It's in Brett's book. He talks about
that's
it.
Right.
That Stu never really got the payments, and then Bruce was just like, fuck it, I'm starting it up again, and they just did it,
right.
And I don't think Vince gave a shit at that point, because he had expanded already and knew that some promotion up in Western Canada wasn't going to really be a major competition to him, and they had a working relationship anyway, so
yeah.
You know, he just went ahead and rolled with the punches, and that's where I think Owen coming in. Because Stampede was pretty much really starting to close up at this point. I know they would stay open to like 91, I think, or something, but they were on the last legs here. So Owen gets a shot, and I think they put him under the mask because they wanted to keep him separate from Brett.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny that he got because it would end up being such an enduring character, and unfortunately, it'd be the last character he'd be. But we won't get into that now. Long, long way, and mm-hmm. we want to enjoy the happy moments before we have to talk about the sad moments. So there's your match there. Again, nothing fancy, just a chance for the fan favorites to get the upper hand, and you know, the match itself really isn't that much. So the next match, again, a match of mid-card guys.
To me now, this is more taking out Warrior and Beefcake. This is more the upper, like closer to main eventing. Mid-card
exactly.
guys, in my eyes.
Exactly, yes. We have a big debut here, too, that we need to talk about. The heel team is Dino Bravo, Harley Race, who's back after being injured.
Yes, and he was injured at the hands of Hulk Hogan, slammed through a table, and, like, what do you, like, lacerate his spleen or something? Something crazy.
It's something, right? he landed, abdomen, like stomach, like chest and stomach first into a table, and he did something. It was a spleen or his intestine, some internal organ injury, and he was gone for a while. It was actually a really good title match. It was on Saturday Night's main event. I think it's an extra. If you bought the Walmart special of Hulk Hogan's Definitive Collection DVD, it's on the fourth extra disc.
He came off the turnbuckle or the apron with that swan dive headbutt he used to do.
Right.
And Hogan rolled off the table and he went through the table. And the metal edge forced its way up into Race's abdomen, giving him a hernia.
Oof.
So he was out. And we'll get into what happened with the crown and all that later on.
But of course, for Harley Race, I'm sure he didn't feel anything. Grizzled old bastard he is. Harley Race, Dino Bravo, Rick Rude, of course, red hot heel. Andre the Giant, still hot, but obviously taking a little notch down.
Yes, and now he's completely out of the main event picture, though. He's pretty much just upper mid-card from here on out.
Yeah, you slowly see him slowing to go down one rung at a time because he just can't move anymore. And here is your big debut, another guy that you and I will love to talk about for the next, almost, if you count back and forth, almost 8 years back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, of course, another son of a legendary wrestler. And we, of course, are talking about Kurt Hennig. Now, we have him down as Mr. Perfect. But is he Mr. Perfect?
Yes. Yes.
He is Mr. Perfect.
He was Mr. Perfect from the start.
Okay.
Outside of maybe a couple like dark and house show matches. But he came in as Mr. Perfect.
Right. Did they have they done the vignettes yet?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, that's what I thought. Of course, the infamous vignettes. Not infamous. Playing ping pong.
Bowling, football.
Bowling.
Well, let's rewind quickly and just talk about his career
his
before
career? Okay.
this. So,
obviously his. Yep. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, son of Larry the Axe Hennig.
Yep.
Big time star in the Midwest, 60s, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. Throughout there, he was known as Cool Kurt Hennig upon his debut in 1980 for the AWA, which is where Larry was a star. Mm-hmm. He stayed there for a while, pretty much right through 87. He was a face, then a heel, had a great feud with Nick Bockwinkel, where they kept doing a lot of teases where he'd win the world title and then never end up winning it. He would lose, actually he would end up winning it, I apologize, and then lose it to Jerry Lawler in May of 88. And that is when he left for the WWF, like very many other AWA stars did during this time. Yes. And he had actually originally had a few matches at WWF under his real name in the early 80s, some Madison Square Garden matches and whatnot. So then by this point, he came back in 88, had the vignettes, like you said, all the Mr. Perfect stuff, arrogant heel. Basically, he was shooting basketball, swimming, bowling, you know, everything, golfing. Hitting home runs.
Yep, and this is where he actually started his very special friendship with Wade Boggs.
Yes,
during the shooting of these vignettes.
Well, that was later. That was later.
He wasn't in the home run vignette.
They did them again in like '93, I thought.
Oh, they 92. Did. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay,
because right. I remember Boggs was on the Yankees when they did it. He had just signed with the Yankees.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, that was like '92. I think they did him again. So, but, oh, okay. Yeah, so yeah, I think it was when he turned face in 92 they did him. But okay. So yeah, he debuts here. He doesn't have the singlet that, you know, he'll become famous for. He gets that in 1989, but here he's just wearing black tights. But already talk about the perfect record and all that stuff, which he would have for a while.
Yes. So there is your heel team, and we have a very and what's very sad, and we mentioned it in our review, the oldest guy on this team, Harley Race, is the only guy that's still alive.
Sadly, yes.
That is very sad. The first guy, the oldest guy on the team, and the guy who's retired first is the only one still alive. So, and we wrote this paper, we wrote this review. God, I told you, I think we just dated how long we've been writing these reviews. We posted this review on our board. Well, we didn't post on this board, but we wrote this review in August of 2005. So that's just a point to make. But
so at that point, he was already the sole surviving.
Yeah, exactly. We just put that because... That's when we originally wrote this review. The babyface team is Ken Patera, Tito Santana, poor Tito, stuck in there, got to carry these teams. Jake the Snake, Jake Roberts, obviously doesn't need to be carried. Scott Casey and Jim Hacksaw, Jim Duggan. Scott, yeah, thanks. Please don't play that song right now. Okay, thank you. Scott Casey is uber jobber, as you put it. He's replacing B. Brian Blair. This is a double replacement.
Yes.
Has that ever happened? The original guy that was supposed to be in this match, the original guy in that slot was Junkyard Dog.
Mm-hmm.
He's obviously long gone by now.
Right.
He was replaced by B. Brian Blair. He ended up leaving, as we mentioned to you a moment ago in the second match. He would be replaced by Scott Casey. You could tell that had to have been like a last minute thing because there could have been had to have been somebody else for Vince to throw in that slot.
Well, the deal with Blair was that the Killer Bees got broken up, and he pretty much saw that, you know, he knew that what was coming. He was basically going to be a jobber. So he said, fuck this, I'm out of here. He quit, and yeah, they threw Scott Casey at the last minute. But Scott Casey was, yeah, pretty much just like we said, a jobber. On weekly TV. It's amazing that he would even get a pay-per-view slot.
I know. I mean, I'm sure he probably framed the check and probably never cashed it. But JYD was in this match to actually continue. He wasn't just there randomly. He was there to continue that whole dynamic with Jake and Rude and all that stuff that happened at SummerSlam.
Right.
So JYD was in this match for an actual paper, for an actual storyline reason. Brian Blair was just there because he needed somebody to fill the spot, and then, as you said, he realized I'm not looking at the lights for anybody, and he flew. So
right, and Casey would stick around as a jobber until 1990.
Yeah, really, that long? I don't remember him past this, but the match obviously is not much. To give you it's actually a longer match than I would have probably wanted it to be. Rude pins Patera at 8:18. They should have pinned him at like 10 seconds.
And this is it for Patera.
Yeah, he's gone. Thank God.
And does he now? Hang on, before we move on from Patera,
sure.
To see what he moves on to do, because I don't think it was much. Did he? Oh, he did. He ended up in the AWA.
AWA, and he did. He went to Herb Abrams' UWF or whatever the hell it was called.
And then he pretty much worked the indie circuit throughout some of the 90s, and that was it.
Yeah. I don't think he ever went to WCW.
No.
During the Nitro years? I didn't think so. And you know what the ultimate indignity for Ken Patera is? He got jobbed out before Scott Casey did. That's your ultimate indignity, Ken Patera, with your creamy legs and your fuzzy hair. You got jobbed out before Scott Casey did, because he would get pinned next by Dino Bravo. Harley Race would get pinned by Tito about 13 minutes in. Tito would then get pinned by Andre about at 14:40. Duggan is disqualified because we have to protect him, you know.
Yeah, again.
At 21:22. Now you guys know why I get annoyed at this. What the hell you got to protect him for? Jesus God, have him pin somebody, for God's sakes, or have him cheat or whatever. I don't know. Jake pins Rude at 28:45, so that officially ends that. That shuts the door on that feud because Jake would start another feud at this show, and that would be with Andre the Giant. Andre gets disqualified for attacking. He actually gets choked. He's choking Jake out with his strap, and I think he gets DQ'd. I believe that's how that goes. And then Kurt Hennig pins Jake after getting choked out by Andre. Andre softened him up, and then Kurt gets the well-deserved
big win for him to get that win there.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So, as mentioned, this match was set up to end one feud for Jake and start up another. He pins Rude, and that feud is over. But then he gets choked out by Andre with the with Andre's strap, and Andre gets DQ'd, but then he's softened up by it, and then Kurt gets the pin off him. So,
yeah, and it was good to see them actually end that feud on pay-per-view, because they never did have that singles match. But like I said, I do believe they fought in Saturday's main event. I'm looking that up right now.
Okay.
I think they fought. I just want to know if it was before or after this match.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
While he's looking that up, just to wrap it up, my comments, and then obviously Justin will make his.
Found it. October 25th, 88. It actually aired on October 29th. It was taped October 25th. Jake Roberts defeated Rick Rude. Oh, actually, that was by DQ. so this was him pinning him.
For God's sakes.
Yeah, it looks like Andre came out after the match, and they got involved. Actually, no, that was the heart attack angle. Was before this match.
Really?
Yep, Andre came out to beat up on Roberts after, you know, him and Rude are fighting. Jake took Damien out of the bag and scared Andre, and Andre fell down clutching his chest. And Jake, the classic guy that he was, stood over Andre's crippled, heart attack ridden body with the snake. So that was heading into the. So they were already feuding pretty heavily then, heading into this match.
Okay. I didn't know that. I always thought that it was. I thought that was like after the Rumble or whatever. I didn't think it was. Okay. Oh, all right. So it's in full gear now then. So, okay. The action in the ring is nothing fancy. I mean, you're dealing with some good professional guys, but nobody, you know, nothing of work rate value here. It's just a chance for Jake to get siphoned over to a new feud. Mm-hmm. Not really a new feud, but so in other words, he was actually feuding with two guys at the same time.
Yeah, I think the Rude feud pretty much ended with that. Even though it was a DQ, I think that was really the end of it, and they just kind of put the punctuation point on it here. And then this allowed Rude to escape finally from the feud and move on to a much bigger feud as 1989 dawned.
Exactly. And Duggan, you know, because he had to be protected because there were things on the horizon for him. And then again, the indignity of Ken Patera having to get pinned before Scott Casey did. So tells you how much Vince thought of him.
And big push for Bravo as well here, getting to be the sole survivor with Perfect.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Good job for Kurt Hennig. You knew right then and there, that Vince had something special. This was a big show for Vince because this is when he really started to, start scouring the talent, and mm-hmm. you knew he was really starting to jack the roster up now. Getting rid of the B. Brian Blairs and the Brunzels and the Ron Basses and all these and the Sam Houstons. And now you're bringing in the Shawns and the Arns and the Tullys and the Perfects. And now you're really starting to load the roster up with grade A talent.
Yes.
And, you know, now you know why all these promoters hated his guts, but you know what? It's the way the world works. So,
and now heading into the main event, I think we might as well talk about the stuff with Harley Race here as kind of the transition.
Yes.
When Harley was hurt, Bobby decided that he was going to give the crown that Harley had been carrying since his debut to one of his other wrestlers, and he decided upon Haku. Tama was now gone, so the Islanders had been split up. Haku was wrestling singles. So he becomes King Haku. They have the coronation. I think it's on one of those best of tapes.
Mm-hmm.
They showed it. And Harley returns just as Harley Race, and as we'll see in early 89, him and Haku would battle over that crown. But so just, you know, setting that up as well, why Haku is now king.
Yes. Yes. And they would end up having a great match at our next vault. But of course, neither of us get to see it. And that'll be one of my future mini rants.
Maybe we'll finally make the effort to watch it in this next week before we do the show. Maybe we should try and find it on YouTube or something.
Yeah, we'll have to watch it, because I've heard it is pretty good. In any case, let us move on to the main event, because this gets pretty loaded. So
yes, main event, of course, sees the Mega Powers return once again as a team. Mm-hmm. And they have the Jobber Buffet with them in this match. And, you know, I like this team just because I like these kind of guys. But it is an odd choices to stick with the Mega Powers when they had other guys that they could have put with them. And, of course, the three guys with them are Hercules, who isn't quite on the Jobber level. He's had recently turned face. We'll get into that in a moment. Mm-hmm. Hillbilly Jim, who we haven't seen since WrestleMania 3 on pay-per-view. And my favorite, Coco Beware.
Right.
Against one of my all-time favorite. Actually, there's a lot of my favorites in this match, but
this is a J-Fave buffet here.
The debut of the tremendous Akeem, the Red Rooster, King Haku, Ted DiBiase, and the Big Boss Man. Of course, Big Boss Man and Akeem were now known as the Twin Towers, and they had a feud going with the Mega Powers, so that'd be kind of a big feud.
Yeah, and actually another tremendous tag team, actually.
Yes.
To just add to the mix.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. So let's just run through these debuts here, and then we'll get to the Hercules turn as well. But the first debut is Terry Taylor, who here is known as the Red Rooster. Kind of a weird gimmick. He started off as a heel under Bobby Heenan's tutelage, but he kept losing and losing and losing. And Bobby, even here after he gets eliminated early, Bobby kept apologizing to the rest of the team for bringing this clown onto the team. And eventually he turned face. We'll get to that at WrestleMania. But I never really understand why they even gave him the name Red Rooster when he wasn't doing the rooster stuff yet as a heel.
Yeah, and obviously, for a little background, Vince had and the creative
team. This is according to rumor. Now, I've never really seen this officially confirmed.
I thought this was pretty close to confirmed. Maybe it's not. I always thought it was pretty much Bible, but I don't know. Anyway, allegedly, we'll say allegedly, and then maybe we'll get Graham to help us look this up. Vince and the creative had the Mr. Perfect character already planned out. They just didn't know who to give it to. And allegedly, it came down to Kurt Hennig or Terry Taylor. Obviously, they got it right. With no disrespect to Terry Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that they got it right. But Terry Taylor was... Why don't they just make him Terry Taylor? Why did we have to invent the Red Rooster to begin with?
Well, he actually debuted as Scary Terry Taylor as a heel. And then... Actually, there were faces, and he teamed with Sam Houston on a TV match, turned on him, and then he picked up Bobby Heenan as a manager, and that's where Heenan renamed him the Red Rooster. And the whole gimmick was that he was kind of like a novice, and Heenan had to help guide him through these matches, which obviously was far from the truth, because if anyone's seen his NWA work in 85, 86, 87, there and in UWF.
He's a tremendous wrestler.
Yes, very, very good wrestler. And it's too bad this ended up kind of saddling him throughout the rest of his career. And he would never really reach probably the levels that he deserved to reach.
Right, exactly.
So that's Terry Taylor. And also another debuting character is Akeem. Over the summer, the one-man gang disappeared from TV. And while he was gone, he grew his hair back out. On the 9/24/88 All-American Wrestling, Mean Gene was invited by Slick to Deepest, Darkest Africa, which actually was probably to some random back alley in Stamford, I'm guessing, or Harlem or something.
Somewhere near Garden Catering, probably, in the back parking lot.
And Slick announced that the one-man gang had officially transformed into Akeem, a jive-talking, dancing white man who thought he was black. It was a tremendous debut, and of course, we also, I'm not sure if the song debuts here, but it'll be there by 89, and that is the awesome theme song, Jive's Old Bro,
yes.
Sung and performed by Slick for Akeem, and eventually Big Boss Man as well, I guess, it's the Twin Towers. So Akeem brought in by Slick, he teams him up with the Boss Man to create a new mega heel team there as well, so... And finally,
you fell in love with this team immediately.
Oh yeah, I was a huge Akeem fan growing up, and I don't know why. I don't know how it happened, but I just did. I just liked the whole shtick. I liked how much effort he put into it. Just good stuff. So on 10-1-88 Superstars, Bobby Heenan and DiBiase were being interviewed and announced that DiBiase purchased Hercules' contract from Heenan to become his personal slave. Hercules was obviously quite offended, as you would expect. He jumped Heenan, but then DiBiase and Virgil beat him down and turned him face. So Heenan once again cashed in and made some money in 1988, just like he did by selling Andre to DiBiase. Now he sells Hercules to him. Hercules ends up turning the face, but Bobby still gets the cash. So Herc now a face, and so he's here pretty much lined up with DiBiase, who's still kind of feuding with Savage and Hogan, but they've kind of moved on to the Twin Towers and kind of involved in their own little drama as well. Coco and Hibbley Jim are just here to fill out the rest of the team, same with Haku.
And just to kind of point out a comment on one of our fun facts on our review. And of course, after, you know, if you want to follow along while you're listening to our podcast, please open up our site, bigelow34.probards.com, and open up the Survivor Series 88 review and kind of follow along with us. Because I have to pull this out. I think it's funny the way you, and I'll give you credit. You get the credit for this one because you did write it. The whole wrestling roosters, fat dancing white men who thought they were black, and indentured servitude. It's like, who was pulling out the PBR 12 packs back then, huh?
Yeah, that is that's quite the run they were on in this late 88 period.
So funny. And obviously, Savage and Hogan. You would have thought, before we get to the comments, I guess they really didn't want to totally kill the entire other mid-card match that had Beefcake and Warrior in there. I guess you don't want to have Hogan and Warrior together. I don't know if they thought the seeds were planted yet.
I think Warrior needed his own showcase match.
Yeah, but I can see
Beefcake. I think probably should have been here, but I guess he still had the thing with Honky going on. Mm.
Yeah, so I guess it was okay to have Coco and he's Hillbilly Jim.
Well, he had ties to Hogan anyway. I mean, even going back to like 85 or whatever, Hogan they'd always been linked as friends. So I mean, that's okay. I guess Coco kind of. Just makes it seem weird because Hibbley's already kind of the designated jobber, but at least he has a connection. I mean, I guess you could say Coco had beef with Boss Man from SummerSlam, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but the other funny thing with Hillbilly Jim and Hogan, Gorilla mentioned as much as he did to Jesse about, you know, Dino Bravo and the damn cheating on the bench press, he mentioned over and over again how Hulk Hogan bought Hillbilly Jim his first pair of black boots. So he mentioned that every Madison Square Garden house show that Hillbilly Jim wrestled, and he always mentioned the boots that Hogan bought for him. So just to kind of go over that whole thing about the correlation between Hogan and Hillbilly Jim. So the match itself, again, kind of unusual. The eliminations early on, Rooster eliminated about 6 minutes in, and as you mentioned, you know, Bobby berates him and apologizes to his team, which is again great early 80s psychology, little things like that you don't see anymore. Akeem, there you go. Get pins Hillbilly. There you go. This is a catch-22 for you, sir. You get Akeem with his first pin, and then 2 minutes later, Coco's job.
I was just happy to see Coco on pay-per-view. Akeem, I needed to see the pin because he was involved in a big storyline here. So to me, he needed this win. Right. Coco, you know, he made three pay-per-views, actually. Three consecutive ones. Mm. WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and here. So... very happy. Glad to see that.
Yes. DiBiase pins Hercules, which obviously would continue their storyline. Savage would end up pinning DiBiase. Did that kind of officially end that, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. He was he was pretty much done at this point, as far as that feud goes. And DiBiase kind of moves on to kind of float randomly, actually, for the next 6 months or so.
And then after that is where we start getting into the meat and potatoes of the main storyline. There's a great visual. Elizabeth. Is it Elizabeth ends up getting? Oh, no. Hogan starts getting beat up outside by, I believe it's by Boss Man and Akeem. And suddenly, Boss Man pulls out his cuffs and cuffs Hogan to the rope. And so, meanwhile, and then Savage, who obviously, you know, on a side note, I know we talk about a lot of guys that were good faces in peril, but when he was a babyface, no one took a shit kicking as good as Savage did.
No, definitely not.
When he was a babyface, he was good. He was even better than Ricky Morton in getting the crap kicked out of him. He was a good seller. I'm going to give Savage credit for that. He was a good seller. So Hogan is locked to the rope while Savage is getting the crap kicked out of him. And the great visual. I love the visual. To me, the little things just make everything great.
Mm-hmm.
And the little visual of Slick, the little prick that he is, dangling the keys in Hogan's face and then laughing at Elizabeth who doesn't know what to do. It's just great. It's just great.
Yes.
So the Slickster deserves all the credit in the world for being a great manager. Right.
He was a great fit with the Twin Towers, too. It was just a good pairing.
Yeah. There's a lot of good jiving and juking. It worked perfectly. So he's jiggling and you know, and he puts the keys in his pocket and they still watch. And Akeem and Bossman are just absolutely tearing Savage apart. And Elizabeth ends up grabbing the keys out of Slick's pocket and unhooking Hogan. I think Haku is still in this match too, so it's actually Haku, Bossman, and Akeem kicking the crap out of Savage.
Yep.
Eventually, Hogan is uncut, is unhooked. Eventually, Savage gets thrown into the corner. His hand goes waving in the air and hits Hogan's hand. So that's a tag. Of course, you know, Gorilla treats him like crap. You know, it's not really a tag. He just kind of threw him into him. Yeah, thanks, Gorilla. He just got the shit kicked out of him for about 15 minutes. And this is where and we'll start getting into this as well as time progresses. And then we correlated at WrestleMania 5, the whole lack of logic in this whole feud. But anyway, Savage gets the tag to Hogan. Hogan comes in and guess what? Buries everybody. Bossman's counted out. Although we will give him credit. They did protect the Twin Towers. Bossman is counted out. Akeem is disqualified. And then poor Haku gets stuck eating the pin.
Yes.
So Hogan gets the pin.
And this is the first of many over the next year. Vintage Jesse Ventura, flipping out over the way Hogan kind of gets the beneficial treatment, right? Because isn't he pretty pissed the way the Twin Towers get disqualified here?
Yes. Yep. And how Bossman gets counted out. Well, 1 year later, you want to talk about that? Might be the next rant we go on when we talk about that one. But
yes.
Anyway, so Savage is still trying to get his bearings after the 15-minute hamburger grating he went through.
Mm-hmm.
And he wakes up. You know, he doesn't know what's going on. All he does is look up, and who does he see? He sees Hogan lifting up Elizabeth. Of course, he's doing his usual posing. Elizabeth – and actually, what's funny, if you really look closely, Elizabeth's looking at Hogan like, do you maybe want to stop posing and go look at your partner?
Yes.
I mean, even Elizabeth's looking at him like – and Hogan's like, nah, whatever. And he's posing, real Americans blasting, he's posing. Elizabeth's looking at him like, can you go look at your friend? Mm-hmm. And Savage doesn't know what planet he's on. Finally,
I still don't know why Akeem was DQ'd, actually. Bossman was beating on Hogan while he was cuffed. Akeem just kind of gets DQ'd for being out there, really.
So there is so Jesse's preferential treatment accusation is correct.
Yeah, and Jesse was pretty off the wall here, from what I remember. He was going pretty crazy.
Yeah. So Savage finally starts to like shake the cobwebs out and gets his bearings. And what happens? He looks up and he sees Elizabeth on Hogan's shoulder. No, you're not here to help me, pick me up off the mat, you know, see how I'm doing. Nah, dance with my girl. Nah, don't worry about it. It's all good. Maybe in the John Cena WWE, that's good. But here, Savage has this look like, hello, what are you doing? You pick up my girl and dance around in the ring with your little music, and I'm sitting here being scraped off with a spatula. So there we see the first cracks in the Mega Powers. Yes, they won the match, and the crowd's all jazzed up, and Richfield's buzzing, and everybody's happy. But lest we know what really is going on, as Savage clearly is not pleased.
Right. The first clearly cracks, is not pleased. The first cracks.
Yes. He is clearly not pleased that Hogan is sitting here celebrating and juking and jiving and playing with his girl while he's sitting here trying to pick his brains up off the floor after, you know, 700 pounds of guy beat the crap out of him. Yeah, that's and the show ends, and there you go. And credits go up. Run out of credits. This is Mid-Atlantic. The copyright goes up. Jesse's pissed. But, do we have an interview at the end here? I don't believe we do.
Yes, there was.
There was. Okay, I will let you go from there.
Actually, was it here? Yeah, it was here, right? Where Jesse talks to Savage backstage and says he smells a rat, or is that the Rumble?
No, that was a Rumble. All right, so there is no interview here.
All right,
okay.
I apologize.
No, that's okay. Nope, that's at the end of the – we'll get – our next vault, we'll get into that. But
okay.
Jesse's just pissed. But he does point out that, you know, Savage, you know, is not pleased. And he's like, Hogan's sitting here juking and jiving and doing his posing while his partner – and even Elizabeth. And I don't even know why they thought that even looked good, you know? I mean, it's not hidden. It's not like, you know, Elizabeth's genuinely looking at him like, can you help your partner here? He's crumpled up in a ball in the corner, and you're sitting here, you know.
No, he does interview him. He does interview him.
He does interview. Okay, so he interviews him twice then. Okay.
Yeah, and Jesse brings up the whole thing about, you know, Savage looking upset, and I think Savage denies it here. And kind of gets on Jesse's case about it. But he does. Yeah. He does mention it, and he does interview him. Okay. And then the Rumble is the I Smell a Rat one.
I Smell a Rat, yeah. But you knew Jesse, who's the master shitster, potster. You know, this is where he starts to... Jesse starts to try and get in all of our heads that something's not quite right. And at the time, we don't believe it. Looking back, of course, we did believe it. But... So there's your show. There is your 1988 Survivor Series. Hogan and Savage. Mega Powers celebrate, but not as rosy, peachy as they were at the end of SummerSlam. No awesome handshake at the end of this one. That's for sure. Savage was a little miffed. But everything's okay. Elizabeth calms him down. Everything's hunky-dory, and Mega Powers are back on track.
Yes.
So there you have it. Overall... I don't know. What do you think? Well, you go first. What do you think of this one? What was
for
your
the show or the match?
Well, both. Yeah, you didn't get a chance to mention it. What were your thoughts on the match? And then you can. And then
I like the match. I like the mix of talent. The end segment is really where it really picked up. Once you get the handcuffing and the stuff with Aku and and the Twin Towers, and that, well, that was fun. I gave it 2.5 in the review. So I, you know, good match. Not great. Not bad. Just good. Right. A lot of good storyline stuff. Obviously, the show as a whole, I liked. And when I kind of compare it to the previous year, I think 87's quality trumps this show. But I think the show is better when it comes to advancing storylines and, you know, debuting characters and pushing guys. 87 was just kind of the novelty of having those kind of matches. 88 is where a lot of stuff happened here, especially, you know, in a trend we would see as the years go on, a lot of the road to WrestleMania starts to be paved here as well. A lot of these feuds that begin here or are really kicked into gear here are ones that carry on through March or April 1989. So as a show, I gave it a C, you know, because to me, the only great match was the tag match. The other ones were all just kind of middling, just kind of there. But for storyline ramifications and for debuts and historically speaking, it's really a very big show.
Yeah, it is. I gave it a C as well. Work rate wise, the tag match carried this show. The other three matches were in essence all storyline creators or finishers, and that was pretty much that. So, it didn't have that kind of overall sizzle that 87 did. But again, you're right. The novelty was there. Now we're kind of used to it, and this was pretty much for storyline advancement, except for the tag match, which just. I don't know. Is that match actually on a DVD?
No, it's never been anywhere. I don't think
the tag 88. No, it needs to be though. It's tremendous. Well, unless you have, of course, the first blast pack or whatever the hell it's called.
Yes.
Of the Survivor Series anthology set. They never released the whole thing, right? Just the first four.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Released all of them yet, which is really odd, but it's the way the company works right now. So there you have it. There is your Survivor Series 88 review. Right here on the Place to Be podcast. Again, you can follow along while you've been listening. If you want to listen to it again and you didn't have it in front of you, go to our board, bigelow34.proboards.com, pull up the Survivor Series 88 review and follow along. If you didn't get a chance to listening to it now, if you want to listen to it again in the future, read along with us. And we have all of our reviews. We're all the way up to the most recent one we have in terms of chronology is SummerSlam 2006. And of course, we'll get there in the podcast at some point. Well, that would be interesting, huh? 2000 what? God knows what.
Yeah,
we will get there, though. We will get there. We promise. So there you have it. We closed the vault.
Yep.
We gotta get Mr. LaRue to get us a sound effect of a safe closing. So that is it for the calendar year 1988. We will be back. We will reopen the vault. Our next review, the 1989 Royal Rumble. A lot of action at that one, you know, we have a lot to advance from that show. But,
yes. And our plan as of now is to kind of flip these shows next week. We're planning on doing the Rumble 89 earlier in the week on Sunday or Monday, and then we'll be bringing you the headlines later in the week because we want to do the pay-per-view picks, and we want to wait till after Raw and the SmackDown tapings. to see if any other matches are up. So this will be our last show for this week. We should have two more coming next week. And then as we hit the summer, once the playoffs in NBA and NFL kind of die off and we hit the summer, we've been churning some pretty interesting ideas that we'll be busting out for kind of theme podcasts.
Exactly.
So we'll be hitting those more once the headline shows kind of thin out a little bit.
And to all of our listeners, and I was kicking this around with Justin in our pre-production, let's put it this way. Expect a lot more audience participation this summer. We want your help this summer as well. So, and we talked about the trivia. We were coming up with some other funny good ideas as well. Now, we talked about the message board. Did you have anything you wanted to – do we have any feedback or anything? I know you're – I didn't take a peek yet today. Do we have feedback we want to – if not, it's fine.
Yeah, we'll save it for the headlines. There's some stuff, but it's mainly NBA related, except for Todd Weber, who says you sound like a very angry Dr. Drew in your rantings.
Is he the guy on is he the sex doctor, Dr. Drew? With Adam Carolla, him and the other guy? Okay.
We'll call you the no sex doctor.
Please. I don't feel like getting into that podcast. We want to continue to push the written equivalent of the Place to Be podcast, which is, of course, our message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. We got a lot of stuff going on. If you're a baseball fan, we do a weekly Survivor picks.
Mm-hmm.
Hop on there. Our man Edge1217, is that his handle? Yeah, is in charge of that. Territory Wars, don't need to tell you enough about that. Our man Rav, doing a lot of great stuff there.
Also, trivia contest, trivia Place to Be trivia podcast contest. We only have a couple of people signed up so far, so please, if you're interested, hit us up on the Facebook page and let us know you're down. So we want to get at least 8 competitors for that. Like I said, we'll come up with a pretty good prize. And you don't need Skype. We can do it via phone. So we want to do that maybe like in July or something like that. So, but we're trying to get people signed up now so we have an idea of what we're looking at. So please do that as well.
Exactly. Two things I want to mention that we both want to mention about that's going on our message board. The first thing, we're doing a Place to Be of fantasy wrestling league. We kind of our guy Mr. Sanchez there. His handle on the board is Disable Smileys. He's doing a fantasy wrestling league, and what we're doing is we're picking current wrestlers that are on TV. And we're, points based on, wins and how they win and how long their matches are and things like that. And there's a couple of slots available in the draft. So if you're interested, when you sign up, don't forget, signing up on the board, absolutely free.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely free. Just sign up and you can do it and you can join us and everything involved. So there's some slots open in the draft. Hop on. You might have to go from behind a little bit, but that's okay. Anything can happen and there's plenty of choices. So. We got that for you. The other thing that we're in the midst of, and Justin's been pimping it for the last few podcasts as well, and that's our Place to Be Greatest Intercontinental Champions Tournament. What we do is we put up rounds, almost like the NCAA tournament. Justin put up this the top 64 Intercontinental Champions ever. There's 66 total. He dumped Dean Douglas and the Mountie and put in the other 64. We're in the second round right now. And the reason I'm bringing this up, besides wanting you to participate, earlier in the podcast, I talked about Don Morocco, and we talked about it on our SummerSlam 88 podcast. If you hadn't had a chance to listen, please listen to that one as well, because that's Morocco's last actual show. One of the matchups in the second round of our Intercontinental Tournament was Don Morocco versus Rick Rude. Now, on paper, normal wrestling fans be like, oh, Rick Rude obviously beat Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 5, had that great summer and awesome match at SummerSlam. That's nice. However, this is a case where probably older fans, not older fans, but fans maybe they're a little bit more wherewithal of stuff to watch. You really got to understand what an awesome, awesome Intercontinental Champion, and a heel for that matter, the Magnificent Morocco was. I mean, for those first the first half of the 80s, from 1980 to pretty much 1985, he was probably one of the best heels in all of wrestling, and definitely looking back, one of the best Intercontinental Champions of all time. And usually Justin and I like to kind of snipe at each other, playfully to kind of go along and get people riled up. But this is one of the times him and I actually really forced an issue together, and it ended up getting some good debate. There were some other people that kind of brought up thinking Rude was better. It was actually a fun little debate. That's what makes our board great, folks. Everybody has different opinions. Everybody has different philosophies, wrestling sports, but the wrestling in particular. And we have a great time. So please join us. Again, bigelow34.proboards.com. Signing up is absolutely free. And it's kind of a, again, it's kind of the written equivalent of our podcast. So, you love listening to Justin and I wax nostalgic and talk about these matches. We do it on the board as well. We have a lot of guys on our board that are a lot of fun. Matt Rotella, the master of the Nocturne, he is on there as well. Derek's on there. What is Rish's name on the board?
I don't think he's on there. He's too cool for us.
That bastard. Next time you two go out for ice cream together, you can tell him to go on the board. I don't think Jordan's on there yet, right? They came from the Blog of Doom, so... go to that site, too. I can never remember the address for that site.
rspwfa2.livejournal.com.
Okay, thank you. I always get the FA2 part wrong. That's a great site, too. The guys are very knowledgeable. You'll have a lot of fun there. historyofwwe.com is, of course, Graham Cawthon's site. He's been a guest before. We'll have him on again in a few months. Talk about the mid-year report of the business right now. Get him ready. Actually, we want to have him on again because he's going to obviously go to the NWA Legends Convention. Mm-hmm. I want to have him back on because I want to hear how that went because we are already in plans to going in 2012. So, Place to Be podcast on location. Should be fun.
Yes.
That's all I got. Anything else we got to pimp ahead? Just to mention, we usually don't do back-to-back vaults, but we are going to. We may not have to release them back-to-back. That depends. We'll have to talk about that. But we may do another vault. Well, we're definitely doing another vault next week. It will be the 89 Royal Rumble. And later in the week, usually we release our headlines ones on Monday nights. We're actually going to do the headline one a little bit later in the week. Mm-hmm. As Justin mentioned, we just want to make sure that we get our full over the edge, listen to me, over the limit. Of course, Owen debuts tonight. What do I say, over the edge? Over the limit pay-per-view, which is on the, which is next weekend, the 22nd. God, these pay-per-views are like firing out like one after the other, huh? I feel like we don't have a break.
I know, it's ridiculous.
Picasso's must love you.
we go a little bit more sporadically. I don't know if we'll make this one. We'll see.
Okay. I have a busy weekend that myself, but I usually can get to our friend Mike's for the show anyway. So, just looking ahead, we have a lot of other stuff. We will have Leanne Griffin back on soon, to talk summer stuff, recipes and. And that social media thing, I'm really looking forward to that because you really got me fired up when we were talking about that last week or 2 weeks ago after we killed Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. Kind of, I'm looking forward to that now because now Rotella, who sits next to me at work, is actually he tweets now.
Oh, geez. Well, I might be done with Twitter then. Once he joins, I think the whole thing's going downhill.
Yeah. Well, he says he doesn't tweet actually. He only because he wanted to follow. And as you know, Matt is a good guy, and sometimes he does sound like he's on some type of medication, but he's a very, very knowledgeable college basketball guy. And he's just following Providence, I guess, Friar recruiting stuff. He gets insights on Cooley's recruits and that kind of thing. That's what he does. But I still have not. So,
well, you're an old son of a bitch.
I am an old son of a bitch, to hell with it. But, I don't even have, it took me forever to be on Facebook, but not, but anyway, and I never did MySpace, but, anyway, we got a lot to look forward to here on the Place B podcast, and we want you here, and we hope you've enjoyed them so far. We've already passed our 25th anniversary, our 25th episode.
Yeah, closing in on 30 next week. We'll hit 30.
Yeah, 30, which means 50 will be 50 will be probably October, maybe.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see when we get there. Depends on the popularity. Hopefully, the popularity continues to grow, and we thank all of you for that. But I think we pretty much exhausted all our pimping for the night. So
yeah, exactly.
Let's go ahead and wrap things up. So
yes.
As always, we will be back next week. We thank you for listening, and for Scott Criscolo, I am Justin Rosero. Take care.
Peace.
Quite a story, said I love her forevermore. But the trouble is, I can't.